This is Case Closed, crime stories from the golden age of radio. Welcome back to Case Closed. Thanks for joining me this Wednesday. We'll hear first this week from Secrets of Scotland Yard. Their episode, The Case of the Hunted Hunter, aired sometime in the 1950s. After that, it's Whitehall 1212, The Case of the Fatal Bath, their story from April 13th, 1952.
How do you do? This is Tybrook. Well, I'm glad to be with you again to keep our rendezvous with the macabre. I've called today's episode The Case of the Hunted Hunter. Whenever public attention is focused on the flight of a notorious criminal, some people admit to some sympathy for the hunted. My advice is don't waste your tears. For in most cases, the man who is being hunted deserves his fate. I think you'll agree with me when you hear today's story of the Hunted Hunter. It is the afternoon of October the 7th, 1942. The fair country of England is overrun with khaki-coloured figures and crisscrossed with the track of 1,000 tanks and lorries. The armies not only of Britain, but of her allies are engaged in the endless rehearsals which form so large a part of modern warfare. Even the loveliest parts of our beautiful countryside clatter to the rattle of Bren gun carriers and machine gun fire. Places that had not heard or seen man or his mischief for many a long month. Hankley Common, a beauty spot in the heart of Surrey. Down one of the leafy lanes comes a crew of marines aboard a Bren gun carrier. Their map reading is not perhaps their strongest point, for they have swerved well off the beaten track and are coming to a cul-de-sac in a little remote dell.
I tell you, Ginger, we're lost.
Don't be blinking, silly. You trust old Allcard.
I reckon old Allcard needs a new pair of spectacles.
I tell you, you've got to keep this track. Come right out on the main road.
Is that so, Mr. Blinking Allcard? Well, what do you make of this? Oh, I pull her up. I'll say you made a mistake. Heaven knows, we'll have to reverse the carrier to get out of here.
Well, you can back it up round by the side of those bushes.
Okay. Ain't it beautiful? I wish we could spend the afternoon here.
Yes, right, we'll have a picnic. I'm sure the sergeant won't mind. Sheriff, let's get going.
By those bushes. You don't want to get bogged down. I'll get out and give you the word. Slowly. All right. Another two feet. That's it. Oi. What is it? Stop for a minute. Look at that. We're sticking out of the ground where the track has turned it up. It's a human arm.
But for that chance, the remains of the body might have lain there for years until time finally removed all trace. Even when the discovery took place, there was little on which to work. One of Scotland Yard's famous murder squad teams, Chief Inspector Green and Detective Sergeant Hodge, were sent down to Hankley Common to tackle the investigation.
They haven't left us much to go on.
No, sir. What do you think the chances are for identification?
Well, it's difficult to tell. The man who did this job was no fool. He dissected the body in such a way that we'll have the devil's own job to work anything out. Yeah, I think we'll take some samples of the soil to see if we can trace any sign of poison. In the meantime, I want this wood sealed off and inserted section by section. Yeah, we'd better have mine detectors to help us. There might be a knife or something of that kind.
Very good.
I'm going back to town to have a word with Fred Chettle.
Fingerprints, eh, sir?
Well, if there's anybody who can help us, it's the fingerprint department at the yard.
Mm-hmm.
Superintendent Fred Cheryl was baffled. Nowhere was there a patch of skin which still held those telltale ridges which might have helped in the identification of the victim. Then into the picture came Dr. Keith Simpson, Home Office pathologist.
I have based my investigation on the small sample of hair with which I was supplied. The hair belongs to a woman, or rather a girl in her late teens. Naturally blonde hair, dyed brown, and bleached again. I should say it was worn in some short hairstyle, probably a bob.
Meantime, back at Hankley Common, Chief Detective Inspector Green was leading an intensive search. Scotland Yard had decided that this was a case of murder in the belief that a body rarely gets buried among the soil of a remote woodland dell for innocent reasons. Whoever had hidden the body and committed the murder had known these woods well. Almost every trace of the victim and the crime had been covered up. Almost every trace, but not quite.
Get this shrubbery cleared away.
Yes, sir. I've got four men working from the back with knives.
Yes. But for heaven's sake, try and avoid disturbing the soil too much. Particularly that pathway.
We went over that this morning, sir. I've taken impressions and some of the footprints.
Good. Now let's go over everything we've found so far.
First of all, sir, there's this little crucifix.
Yes. Probably worn by the girl.
Then we found these pages from the Bible and a few sodden bits of letters.
Any luck with deciphering them?
No, sir. I'm afraid the rain has practically washed the writing away. Then we came across this bit of card.
Part of an identity card, isn't it?
Yes, sir. I've had that checked with the yard and the samples tally. Unfortunately, it's just a piece of the corner, and so far we've not found any more.
Oh, come over here!
Oh, what's that?
Sounds as though they found something, sir.
Oh, come on.
Run over here, sir. Around the back of those bushes.
All right, we're coming.
There we are, sir.
Yes. What in heaven's name?
It's some sort of that.
More of a shelter.
It's made of woven saplings, sir. Very neat job.
Yeah, I'll tell you what it is. It's a wigwam. My boy's a scout, and they teach him to make this sort of thing.
I doubt if they can make it as well as this one, sir. It's really a beautiful job of work.
Yeah, there must be some sort of expert in this country who can tell us something about wigwams. I'll get in touch with the yard.
And from the hundreds of different experts who are at the disposal of Scotland Yard came a man who was, believe it or not, an expert on wigwams. He was motored down to Hankley Common post-haste, and after examining the structure carefully, said to Detective Inspector Green,
"The work of a Cree Indian."
Cree Indian? What in heaven's name was he doing on Hankley Common?
What indeed? Meantime, from the other fragments of evidence, Scotland Yard was starting to piece together the trail which had been so carefully concealed. To the police laboratory went the stained and sodden letters. The bit of identity card was traced to its office of origin. Questions, questions to every person who lived, worked, or moved near Hankley Common. A blonde girl, bobbed hair, a Cree Indian.
Yes, I remember seeing a girl like that. She lived in the woods. Several months it'd be. I was out late at night on my business.
Oh, what business?
Well, sir, I do occasionally take a little walk at night.
Oh, all right, I know. Poaching. Still, never mind that. I'm concerned with something a lot more serious. You say you saw this girl.
That's right, sir. Not often, mind you. She was cunning-like. Didn't like herself to be seen. Kept herself hidden. There was a man with her. He was a soldier.
Oh, you mean he wore battle dress?
That's right, sir. But he weren't like our lads wear. Different, somehow.
Oh, how do you mean, different?
Well, sir, it were more classy-like. And this soldier fella, he weren't English.
You mean he was colored?
Well, he weren't English. But he were a real smart man. I only saw him twice, and it were by accident. He was standing over there by that tree. Quite still-like. Just like on the movies. Like, a Red Indian.
Hello? Is that Canadian Army Records? This is Detective Inspector Green of Scotland Yard. Yeah, I want your assistance. Yeah, you had a camp near Godalming in the winter of 1941 and the early spring of the following year. Yeah, well, I'd like very much to have from you a roll of all the personnel stationed at that camp. And in particular, I'm interested in any soldier of Indian parentage. Yeah, that's right. Ah, good. Tomorrow morning. Right, thank you very much.
But remember, all that Scotland Yard had at this time was the knowledge that a girl, as yet unidentified, and a man who looked like an Indian had been seen together in the woods. But now all the resources of the Yard were devoted to finding an answer to the question, whose body was it that had lain in that dell at Hankley Common?
Yes, that's right, sir. The identity card did come from his office.
You can tell that from the fragment of the upper part of the card?
Yes, sir. There's just enough to give us the district for certain. Still, it could be one of 10,000 different numbers, so I can't help you much more than that.
Oh, wait a minute. You say there are 10,000 possible numbers.
Yes, sir.
Well, if I told you it belonged to a girl of 18 or 19 years, how long would it take you to sort out the cards into that category?
Oh, in that case, only a few hours, sir.
Right. I'll wait.
And so, almost by the time the report had come in from the Canadian Army Records Office, Scotland Yard had managed to identify the body as that of Joan Pearl Wolfe, a 19-year-old girl who had run away from home and who had disappeared.
Green here. Yeah? Oh, good. And were there any Indians on the strength of that unit?
Ah, I see.
Well, would you mind spelling that name? A-U-G-U-S-T-E-S-A-N-G-R-E-T.
Hmm.
And where's he now?
Well, thank goodness he hasn't gone overseas.
Yes, I should like to see him. Oh, well, if he's as near as that to London, perhaps we can bring him into the yard for a little talk. Yes. All right, then. We'll make it 12 o'clock tomorrow morning.
You were stationed at Godalming last year?
Yes.
Did you know a blonde girl?
Yes.
Did you live with her in a wigwam you constructed on Hankley Common? Was her name Joan? What else? Was it Joan Pearl Wolfe?
Yes.
Then why not say so?
And so it went on. Cautious and non-committal, Sandford seemed completely unperturbed by the investigation. He was asked to give his fingerprints, but told he need not do so. Without a word, he thrust his hands deep into his pockets. That was that. The Yard had not enough evidence to charge him, so he went back to his unit. However, Green was convinced that provided the woods could yield sufficient evidence, Sandford would prove to be the killer. The hunt for evidence was on. One of the first discoveries in a renewed search of the wood in Hankley Common was the marks of a knife.
Well, rather a strange shape, isn't it?
Yes, sir, just like a parrot's beak.
Where did you find those knife marks?
Several places, all over the wigwam.
Oh, we'll take an impression of these knife marks and let Dr. Simpson have them. I'm going to have a talk with him. And so, you see, any evidence you can give us as to how the murder was committed would be of enormous value.
Her skull was shattered with some kind of club, but she was also stabbed.
Take a look at this cast. The blade is shaped like a parrot's beak. Could this have been the weapon?
Well, can you leave this cast with me?
Yeah.
I'd like to have go over it, mate.
Dr. Keith Simpson reported back that a knife of this description had been used for the murder.
That knife must be found.
We've been over the ground very carefully, sir.
We'll go over it again and again. Whatever happens, we must find that knife.
The woods were searched again. Then, following a fresh line, Green ordered Sandford's barrack room to be searched. A number of his companions were brought in for questioning.
Knife with a blade like a parrot's beak? Sure, I remember a knife like that. Funny you should come to mention it.
I didn't know Sangrid very well, but one afternoon I walked out to the wigwam he had built in the woods. I saw the knife stuck in a tree. The only reason I was there was I had to get Sangrid back. He had been absent without leave. And there was a girl with him there. No, I've not seen the knife since. Why? What's up?
By this time, a fresh unit was occupying the barracks where Sangrid had been stationed. A squad of men were put to work to search every inch of the ground near the huts. And finally, they found the knife in the bend of a toilet drain under the floor of one of the wash houses. Dr. Keith Simpson, the pathologist, came down to the dell of Hank Common and in the twilight of an October evening carried out a dramatic experiment.
We found this club in the woods. We have reason to think it may have been used by Sangrid. Now, here's the knife. First of all, I'd like to match the knife against the mark in the tree. And then, Dr. Simpson, I'd like to match the club and the knife against that reconstruction you have of the girl's skull.
I see. All right, then. Well, let's make a start.
Painstakingly, the measurements were compared. The chain of evidence was almost complete. Sangrid was brought under escort to Scotland Yard for another interview.
Now, Sangrid, I want you to take a look at this. You see this club?
Yes.
Have you ever seen it before?
No.
You've never touched this club in your life?
No.
Well, in that case, you'd have no objection to giving us your fingerprints. That would be conclusive proof, wouldn't it? Will you allow us to take your fingerprints?
Yes.
Good.
In point of fact, the club had been carefully wiped long ago. There was no trace of a fingerprint on it. Inspector Green knew that, and Sangrid knew it too. What Sangrid did not know was that Green had another reason for wanting those fingerprints. No sooner had they been given than a photograph of them was on its way to the headquarters of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. From Canadian fingerprint records came a radio message in reply.
August Sangrid, 4 times convicted in 12 years for crimes of violence. Last offense, September 14, 1938. Threatening to shoot a woman.
And so Sangrid was taken to the dell in the woods on Hankley Common. By now it was winter and the trees stood bare. The frozen earth rang under his infantry boots. His face showed no expression as he was taken along the woodland paths. His step was sure and he seemed confident that he could make no mistake.
Now, Sangrid, you see this wigwam?
Yes.
You made it?
Yes.
You lived in it with Joan Wolfe?
Yes.
This cooking fire, she made food for you?
Yes.
And this picture cut in the wood, she made this?
Yes.
Our little gray home in the West. You lived here happily?
Yes.
You never had a quarrel?
No.
No quarrel. Always peace?
Yes.
You see that path over there, Sangrid?
Yes.
If you follow it for 30 yards, you'll come to a clump of bushes. Just there, we found her body, or at least all that remained of her body. We believe that she ran down that path. She ran in terror. Somebody had stabbed her. She was trying to escape from him. The man who stabbed her hunted her down that path. He caught up with her by those bushes. He hit her with his club again and again. She stumbled down among those thorn shrubs. He went on beating her until she was dead. Come on down there. I'll show you where it happened.
No, that way no good. That way we never go. No good to go down that way.
Are you afraid?
Afraid of no man.
Now, what are you afraid of? Ghosts?
No good to go down that way. You go. I wait here.
He stood rigid and stubborn at the top of the murder path, nor could he be persuaded to walk that way.
All right, Hodges. I think we've got enough now. I'm going to apply for a warrant.
So, a few weeks later, Sanquit stood in the dock at Surrey Assizes in for the murder of Joan Pearl Wolfe.
Listen to me, sir. Handwritten in pencil on the side of this crude wigwam were these words. In the midst of all thy glory, cast a look of pity upon all who are suffering against life's difficulties, separated from those they love, the lonely and the friendless. Did you write those words?
No.
Did Joan Pearl Wolfe write them? You cannot write, can you, Sanquit?
No.
But those words were read to you?
Yes.
Why were those words written? Because you'd quarreled with this girl?
He stood in the dock, still inscrutable, stubborn. He alone knew the secret of what had happened in the woods. But against Gunyard, there are no real secrets. One by one, the experts went into the dock. Simpson, the pathologist, Phil, the fingerprint expert, and Green of the murder squad. Together, they built up the story of how this strange 28-year-old Pikesman had met this 19-year-old convent-educated girl. How they'd lived together in the woods and how they had quarreled. From a tiny crucifix, a footprint, and a piece of bone, they built up that awful picture. The hunter pursuing the girl through the sheltering trees. A skirt caught in a thorn bush. The stumbling feet and then his merciless attack. It used all the skill of generations upon generations of hunters to conceal his deadly work, but that skill had not been enough. And so he stood there in the dock watching the jury as they filed back to give their verdict.
Gentlemen of the jury, have you considered your verdict?
We have.
And do you find the accused guilty or not guilty?
Guilty.
He did not flinch when he heard the verdict. He looked straight ahead. What went on in his mind? Was he thinking of some words the girl had said to him one afternoon 9 long months ago? We learn of these words from the Canadian military policeman who had given evidence. He had come to their wigwam in the woods in order to collect Sanquit and bring him back to camp. Firmly but politely, he had ordered the girl to leave. He had then said,
"Goodbye, August. Remember the burning wood, our fire, and the loveliest smell in the world. I'll never get our little home in the west."
And so Sanquit had gone back to camp. But one evening he had returned to his home in the woods and to the blonde girl with the short bobbed hair. Perhaps it was late night. Maybe they talked.
Come here. Don't let's quarrel. I promise you I'll never go away. Auguste, what are you doing with that? What are you doing with that knife? Now don't be silly. Auguste! Get away! What are you going to do? Oh, God, put down that knife! Please don't follow me. Leave me. Let me go. I'll go away. No! Oh, God, please don't. Oh, Lord, baby.
Yeah.
August Sangre, the jury have found you guilty of this terrible crime. And the sentence of the law which I have to pronounce upon you according to the statute is this. That you, August Sangret, be taken to the place from which day, and that from thence you be taken to a place of execution, and that you be hanged by the neck until you be dead. And may God of his infinite mercy have compassion on your soul.
So ends the story of August Sangret. Next time you read in your newspaper of a criminal being hunted by the police, don't think of the criminal. Think of the victim and spare your pity for him. Joining you again soon to tell you some more of the secrets of Scotland Yard. Until then, this is Clive Brooke saying goodbye and pleasant dreams.
Whitehall, 1212.
This is Scotland Yard.
For the first time in history, Scotland Yard opens its official files to bring you the authentic true stories of some of its most baffling cases.
These are the true stories, the plain, unvarnished facts, just as they occurred, reenacted for you by an all-British cast. Only the names of the participants have, for obvious reasons, been changed. The stories are presented with the full cooperation of Scotland Yard.
Research on Whitehall 1212 comes from Percy Hoskins, chief crime reporter of the London Daily Express. The stories for radio are written and directed by Willis Cooper. Here is Chief Superintendent John Davidson, custodian of the famous Black Museum of Scotland Yard.
Good afternoon. This exhibit from the files of the Black Museum is labeled 50MR242, which is the file number of the case you are here about. You'll note that it is not a very good wedding ring. That is, it is of intrinsically poor quality. The base metal of which it was made shows through the shabby, worn covering of gold wash with which it was once adorned. Base metal. It's as base as the purpose for which the ring was purchased for 6 shillings. As false as the promises of the bridegroom who bought it and took it back again after it had served its purpose. I hope you'll pardon my sentimentality. A policeman is generally not entitled to that luxury. I ask you to judge for yourself. Inspector Stephen Rockhead, who was Scotland Yard's principal representative in this case, shares my feelings, I think.
Your feelings seem to have been shared by a great many persons who participated in this case, John. Witness Mr. Justice Brewster and what he didn't say at the trial.
I'm afraid I don't remember, Stephen.
He omitted the phrase, "May the Lord have mercy on your soul," when he sentenced Stanley Brown to death. Five O-242 began for me with what, if it happened in a drama for the wireless, would be described as an incredible coincidence. A letter had been passed to my desk. It had been addressed to Criminal Investigation Department, New Scotland Yard. A letter from a man named Crittenden, living at Aston Clinton in Buckinghamshire. The CID receives dozens of letters of its type daily, and it is our generally tiresome duty to read them all. Whilst I was glancing over it, a visitor was announced. Before he sat down, he laid a 3 days-old copy of the Morning Telegraph on my desk.
You're Inspector Rockhead?
Yes.
My name's Ramsay, Norman Ramsay, formerly of Blackpool, now resident in Shepherd's Bush.
Yes.
I've been carrying this paper around for 3 days.
Why?
This article here, sir.
This one?
Here.
Highgate Tragedy, Bribe drowns in bath.
That's the one.
What about it, Mr. Ramsey?
I've come here because I was a witness to a very similar case 2 years ago.
Where, sir?
In Blackpool, where I formerly lived. A bride drowned in her bath just 2 days after her wedding.
What was her name?
Brown.
I see. Well, Mr. Ramsey, you are to be commended for bringing this to our attention. That was her husband's name, I assume.
Stanley Brown was his name.
What happened to him, do you remember?
I don't know. He went away the day his wife was buried. In rather a hurry, I thought.
Are you making an accusation, Mr. Ramsey?
I must admit I didn't like the fellow.
Are you making an accusation?
I am telling you what I know about an extraordinary coincidence, sir.
Excuse me. Did you know the wife's maiden name?
Oh, I believe it was Crittenden.
Crittenden?
No, that's right, yes, I'm sure.
Alicia Crittenden.
Oh, you've heard of the case.
Do you remember how the late Mrs. Stanley Brown, the former Alicia Crittenden, was buried, sir?
I most certainly do. It was the most shocking thing I'd ever heard of. She was buried in a common grave.
With three other deceased persons in the cheapest part of the graveyard.
How do you know that?
Because I have a letter here in this morning's post from her father relating the same facts you've just told me and considerably more besides. You speak of a coincidence, Mr. Ramsey.
Well, this is amazing.
It's more than that, sir. I'm afraid I shall have to ask you a few more questions. We talked for 2 hours. Mr. Ramsey remembered a great many things about the death of the bride and her bath at Blackpool. He remembered a representative of an insurance firm who'd asked him his opinion of Alicia Crittenden Brown as a potential risk for life insurance. He recalled having been asked to witness two newly drawn wills, one of the husband and one of the wife, in which each left the other everything. He recalled the circumstances of the fatal bath.
But they had two small rooms on the first floor in this house. It was a sort of private lodging house, you see. Extremely charming people owned it, Mr. and Mrs. Ralston. I've heard that they've gone to America. But I remember the circumstances quite well indeed. The bathroom was just above the kitchen where the rest of us were sitting this particular Saturday night.
Do you remember exactly when it was?
Early in March, if I remember correctly. She was upstairs. I remember his saying to her, "Now mind, don't get the bath too hot. Remember your seizures."
Her what?
Seizures. She had epilepsy, I believe. Well, then it was very quiet on the floor above us, and at last Brown said he was a bit worried about her and went up. Came back almost at once and said, "Oh, she's all right," or something like that. Sat down, played the piano for a while. Then he went upstairs again, and I heard him calling out that she had drowned. Mm. The doctor came, and that was the whole thing.
And you have certain suspicions?
Not enough to go to the police. Before, I mean.
You obviously have now.
Did you notice the name of the husband of the bride who was drowned in the bath at Highgate?
Why, I...
Look at the paper here.
Stanley. J. Stanley.
Stanley Brown's full name was James Stanley Brown.
Well, Mr...
I'm sure you understand, Inspector, that I realize I may be doing the man a dreadful injustice. He may, so far as I know, be the victim of...
Well, coincidence? Yeah?
Well, yes, put it that way, if you like. I shall never forgive myself if I've stirred up suspicion of an innocent man, but...
You'd recognize him if you saw him?
Of course. Never forget him. Tall, heavy man with a long face like a horse, perfectly bald head, and the most extraordinary eyes I've ever seen. Absolutely dead eyes. Like some primordial monster from the slime of an ancient sea.
Are you a poet, Mr. Ramsey?
I'm sorry. He is rather fishy looking. Yes, of course I'd recognize J. Stanley Brown.
Excuse me. Will you put me through to the police at Highgate, please? Right. Ring me when you get them. I should like to ask you to come up to Highgate with me. Could you come this afternoon?
Oh, this afternoon? Well, let me see.
Sorry.
That's all.
Inspector Rockheed speaking, Scotland Yard. Oh, yes. Hello, is that you, Richard? Oh, I wanted to talk to Chief Inspector Richard Yarber at Highgate. Right. Oh, there you are, Richard. Stephen Rockheed here. Oh, fine, thank you. How are you? The young woman who died in her bath, when was it? The day before yesterday? Right. Mrs. Stanley, I'd like to have a look at her husband, Richard. Where would I find him? I mean, does he live at... What?
What's the matter,
really?
Sir?
Can't hear you, old boy. Oh, when? What? Interesting. The same day she was buried, eh?
What?
Shh. Very sorry. That's very interesting. How long have they been married? Says recently married in the paper here. 3 days.
It's Brown, I know it. Sorry, sir.
Well, yes, I would rather like to talk with him. I think we'd better pass the word to have him picked up.
Is he gone?
If you please, Mr. Ramsey.
Sorry, I'm just trying to...
What's he look like? Half a tick. Where's my pencil?
Right here.
Now, go ahead. Tall, about 14 stone. Big chap, isn't he? What kind of extraordinary eyes?
Oh, that's him.
Like an insane what? What? Thin and heady? You do turn a phrase, Richard. Excuse me. What are you saying?
Bald-headed. Ask him if he's bald.
Yes. Bald-headed chap, is he? Oh, curly black hair.
Well, but that's not him. It can't be.
Will you please be quiet, Mr. Ramsey?
Well, he was perfectly...
Sorry, Richard. Yes, thanks. Give our people here at the yard the fullest description you have, and thank you very much indeed. No, I'm not sure, but the circumstances of his wife's funeral do interest me. I'm very curious. Thank you.
Is he gone, sir?
He's gone, yes. And where do you suppose his bride is?
Why, you said she was buried.
She is buried. In a common grave with four other miscellaneous corpses. Just like the other bride of 3 days who died in her bath. Mr. J. Stanley of Highgate, who bore certain resemblances to Mr. James Stanley Brown of Blackpool, was not to be found. The attending physician at Highgate, who'd signed the death certificate for the drowned bride, told us that she had visited him the afternoon of the fatal bath. He had given her some powders for what she described as a migraine headache, which was sometimes, she said, so severe that she had fainted from the pain. The powders had not been unsealed when the body was found, although the husband had told him that his bride had complained of a nagging headache immediately before her bath. You certified her death, of course, as from natural causes, I asked the doctor.
I did, sir. I was convinced at the time, and still am, that a sudden twinge of pain caused her to faint. She slipped down in the bath until her head was under water, and she drowned before aid could reach her. She was naturally alone in the bathroom, sir.
Do you recall anything that her husband said at the time, sir?
Well, the man was all but prostrated. He kept repeating that if he'd only insisted she take some of the medicine I had given her, she'd still be alive.
Would she have been?
In effect, I so certified, Inspector.
A post-mortem might...
I saw no need there, nor do I now of a post-mortem. If I may mention an opinion, I think you're being needlessly officious, sir.
I'm sorry, Doctor.
Reply by Mr. Francis Harrington, insurance broker of Highgate, to an inquiry by Inspector Rockheed of Scotland Yard.
No, I did not pay the amount of the insurance to Mr. J. Stanley. Mrs. Stanley was insured in the amount of £1,000 sterling. Yes, he called me early on the following Monday morning with a copy of the death certificate, but, you know, there are certain formalities, you know, with the Home Office, and I was unable to give him a check. Yes, he was very annoyed. No, I did not think it unusual. I found that people are quite unpredictable in matters relating to life insurance. Yes, he said he would be away for some time. He said he would notify me of his address and I could send the check there. He notified me today, and I've already sent him the company's check for £1,000 sterling. Yes. I think I can give it to you, yes. It's 8 Rotherhithe Crescent, South End. You're quite welcome, sir.
An inquiry at 8 Rotherhithe Crescent, South End, disclosed the fact that this was an accommodation address. Stanley had picked up his check, cancelled his arrangements for receiving mail, and gone away from there, leaving no forwarding address. I was having a plate of cold roast beef with John Davidson, the Black Museum man. He was a superintendent then. In the course of our meal, I told him the sequence of events. John finished his roast beef in silence. What do you think, John? I asked.
A little too well done for me, I'm afraid.
What?
I like my roast beef rare. Wasn't that what you were talking about?
You know quite well I wasn't, John.
Say, pass those pickles if you're not going to eat them, will you?
Well?
Excellent pickle. Why, if you're asking about the story of the brides and the bar, Stephen...
I am.
Well, I'm forcefully reminded of a biblical quotation. The wicked flee when no man pursueth. It's Proverbs 28, first verse.
We're pursuing this fella.
Yeah, but he doesn't know it. Far as he knows, no man is pursuing him.
Yes, but he...
And he's obviously fleeing. Therefore, he must be wicked. QED.
On the face of things, these two deaths are coincidences, John.
Well, it's quite possible.
We don't even know it's the same man. Bald-headed men don't suddenly grow curly black hair.
Well, sometimes they wear wigs.
Yeah, I thought of that. Have to find him to prove it.
Is there any more beer in that jug? Thank you. Look, I don't think you're going about finding him in the right way, Stephen.
Do you have any suggestion, then?
No more of that beer, I suppose. That's a pity. Well, I think if I were doing it, I'd take my cue from that proverb I just quoted.
Well?
I'd give the wicked something to flee from. He just might flee right into your arms.
Perhaps you'll tell me how to do that one.
Of course. Well, I'd dig up those girls' bodies and let Henry Bird, the pathologist, have a look at them.
Hmm.
Can't say I envy him. One of them's been dead a year or more, hasn't she?
2 years.
Poor Henry. Well, at least he could tell you whether the chap's really wicked or not. If he is, then cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war. And Julius Caesar, Act 3, Scene 1.
After a series of annoying explanations on my part, I succeeded in obtaining the necessary permission to exhume the bodies of Alicia Crittenden Brown at Blackpool and of the late Mrs. J. Stanley at Highgate. Henry Bernard, the long-suffering pathologist, was assigned to perform the postmortems on both bodies. Accordingly, he proceeded first to Blackpool in Lancashire for the first of the examinations. I waited impatiently. 2 days later, I received a telephone call from that well-known watering place. It was, of course, Bernard.
Henry Bernard here, Rocky. Well, I've finished. It's, of course, impossible to say at this late date whether the woman was really a sufferer from epilepsy. I told you that before I came up here. What? No, there's no evidence of any organic disease. No, she wasn't poisoned. No, there's no indication whatever of any wound of any kind on the body. Lacking any other evidence, I can assure you there is none. We must accept the fact that she drowned as a result of an epileptic seizure. No, there can be no more to add.
Excuse me, there's somebody at the door.
Conferring this evening with the doctor who signed the death certificate.
Excuse me, sir.
Yes, what do you want?
I'm talking on the... police station just telephoned you. They waited, but then they said they wouldn't wait any longer. And pleased to give you the message at once, as it is extremely important.
Well, spit it out. What do they want?
It was Inspector Wogan, sir. He said to tell you that there's a lady complaining to them that her husband is threatening to kill her.
Now, look here, Constable. I'm in no mood to be bothered with details that can be handled by... Tell them to do their own work. I'm busy. Of all the... Hello, Bernard. Hello, are you there? Hello. Oh, he's hung up, damn it. Now, look here.
Well, they said you'd be most interested when you hear the lady's name, sir.
Well, what is her name, then?
Mrs. J. Stanley Brown, sir.
I hurried at once to Wardour Street, where Mrs. Marigold Brown, the alleged wife of the vanishing J. Stanley Brown, had come to report the threat in her life. She was a tall, angular woman, singularly unattractive, wearing a shapeless gray tweed coat and a series of large aluminium bracelets which clanked. She sat stiffly in an uncomfortable chair and answered my questions quietly.
Yes. We've been married for 11 years, Stanley and I.
You could, of course, produce your marriage certificate, Mrs. Brown.
I have it at home.
Mr. Brown and you live together?
He's away a great deal. I'm alone for several months at a time.
Where does he go?
His business takes him to various parts of the country.
What is his business, Mrs. Brown?
I'm afraid I don't know.
Does he...
He doesn't give me much money. When he's away, I generally go into service. I'm considered quite a good housemaid.
Do you know what your husband does when he's away from home?
I think he deals in second-hand goods in various places.
Do you hear from him when he's away?
He sends me picture postcards.
From where, for example?
Portsmouth, Bristol, various places. Blackpool.
Where?
Blackpool. That was a long time ago. 2 years. He doesn't tell me his business.
This is the first time he's threatened your life?
I've been a good wife to him all these years.
Would you answer my question, please, Mrs. Brown?
Well, he said things in the heat of the moment. Not threatened me, but he said he wished he was well rid of me.
And this time?
He meant it. I could tell from his face that he meant it. I could tell by the way he shouted. And he laid hands on me, too.
Your eye?
Yes.
What was the occasion for this?
I don't ask Stanley for money very often. But this time I knew he had some money. He'd been drinking when he came back from Highgate.
Highgate, you say?
Yes. When I asked him if I could let me have £2 for a new dress and coat, he flew into a rage. He'd been drinking, I said. And he flew at me and broke my glasses and threatened my life.
Just what did he say to you, Mrs. Brown?
He said he'd take me and drown me.
Police stations throughout England were advised that Scotland Yard wanted J. Stanley Brown, not merely for questioning, as we would have had to say before his poor shabby wife made her complaint. Now he was wanted for a violation of the Summary Justice Act of 1879, threatening a breach of the King's peace, which is felony. The questioning would come later. Henry Bernard, the pathologist, had left Blackpool and gone to Highgate for the post-mortem on the second bride. I came to the mortuary at his request.
This is my assistant, Miss Littlejohn, Inspector Ruckin.
How do you do, Mr. Littlejohn?
Nice to know you, sir.
Thank you very much.
I've found out something, Inspector. Come over here, please. Dead bodies don't bother you, I hope.
Oh, no.
I've brought the last Mrs. Stanley, called himself at Highgate, didn't he?
Stanley, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's nothing at all I could discover on the one at Blackpool. But this one is much more recent, you see. Little more than a week.
Yes. She must have been quite good-looking.
Puzzles me why girls like this will marry such rascals. I understand he's hideous.
So we hear. Well, what did you find to show me?
Well, I'll get to it in a second. First, though, the bride at Blackpool. She didn't have any epilepsy.
I thought you said you couldn't be sure.
I can be sure of one thing. Look. I've had a bathtub brought in here.
Where? Oh, there. Well, what's
now,
that?
Now, be patient. This is exactly the same type of bathtub in which the woman at Blackpool was drowned. And by another of those coincidences you're so fond of, also the same as the one at Highgate. I've seen them both. Now I'm going to show you something. Miss Littlejohn.
Yes, sir. Oh, I hope that water isn't cold.
You've had it filled?
Of course. Now, Miss Littlejohn, if you'll take off your clothes.
It's all right, Inspector. I've got a bathing suit under my smock. Oh, now, you didn't think...
take off your shoes, Miss Littlejohn.
Oh, all right.
Now get in the tub.
I feel most awfully silly.
You'd feel sillier without your bathing suit. Get in, please.
Yes, sir. Oh, I thought you said this was warm.
Sit down. Now, the first reaction in an epileptic seizure is a sudden stiffening of the muscles, especially of the legs. Miss Little John will now stretch out her legs sharply, observe. If you please, Miss Little John.
Oh, can you not this?
Uh-huh.
There we are.
Well, nothing happened.
Of course. An epileptic would merely prop herself against the foot of the tub, her back resting against the slanted end, and her head out of the water, like Miss Little John. She's wedged in there. But if her legs were relaxed... Sure, Miss Little John.
Here you are.
Now, I'll show you something else. Step around here to the end of the tub.
Now, be careful now.
Take off your coat. Doesn't matter if your shirt sleeves get wet.
What are you going to do?
You're going to do it. Reach down in the water.
Now, do be careful.
Take hold of Miss Little John's ankles.
Well, I...
Go on.
Excuse me, Miss Little John.
Now, do be careful now.
Lift her feet out of the tub. Hold her feet up. Hold them up.
Yes.
Hold them up.
But her head is underwater, man.
Of course, old chap. She's drowning. That's the way the young lady over there on the table was murdered. Oh, I say, drop her feet. She is drowning.
I would not recommend that you try that trick with a friend. It took artificial respiration to revive Miss Little John. And when Bernard showed me marks on the ankles of the drowned bride, marks that fingernails would have just fitted into, well, we measured the tiny scars and photographed them for comparison with the fingers of Stanley Brown, should we ever catch him. It was almost exactly 7 weeks later. I had a telephone call from Mrs. James Stanley Brown, the living one. Please come to my flat at once, she said. It's of the highest importance. I went there. Mrs. Brown was quite excited.
I'm so glad you've come, Inspector.
What's happened, Mrs. Brown?
Oh, Inspector, I want to withdraw the charge against my husband. Please say I can withdraw it.
Why, Mrs. Brown, I...
Please say I may. Oh, please.
I'm afraid I'll have to know more about this, Mrs. Brown, before I can answer
that. Oh, it's quite simple. We've made up again.
What?
I know, but we've decided it was so awfully silly for us to be quarreling, and he's promised.
You've seen your husband?
Yes, he came back to me. Oh, we've had such a long talk. We're going to start over again and...
Whose idea was this?
Why, his, of course. And now I want to cancel a silly charge I laid against
him. It wasn't a silly charge, Mrs. Brown.
So ashamed of myself. I simply must have you drop these charges. They're only a formality anyhow. Oh, we're going to be so happy. Already he's begun to treat me just like a bride, Inspector.
Where is he now, Mrs. Brown?
The dear great boy.
Where is he, please?
You won't believe it, but he's upstairs right this minute, preparing me an heavenly bath. Like a bride.
She wept bitterly when I arrested him in the bathroom alongside the inviting full tub, stinking of cheap bath salts for this pathetic last bath. Despite the things he'd done to Marigold Brown, her dreams died hard, but they died when she heard the story of the other brides who had their baths. Henry Bernard proved the points he'd made to me and Miss Little John. In the face of it all, Stanley Brown confessed. On that day, Marigold Brown stopped weeping and believing in this black-hearted man. He was found guilty, of course, and sentenced to death. He was guilty of the death of three women. On the day he was hanged at Wandsworth, Marigold Brown committed suicide. I think there's some good advice in what Superintendent John Davidson told me.
Give the wicked something to flee from. Sometimes they'll flee right into your arms.
heard another in the series Whitehall 1212. Research is from Percy Hoskins of the London Daily Express. Among those heard in today's story of Scotland Yard case number 50MR242 were Harvey Hayes, Winston Ross, Horace Braham, Lester Fletcher, Patricia Courtley, and Beulah Garrick. The stories for radio are written and directed by Willis Cooper. The fight against cancer is your fight. You're personally concerned with its disease, for anyone can develop it. And there is something you can do to protect yourself and your family. First, familiarize yourself with the facts about cancer. Interesting, easy-to-understand literature may be obtained from the local unit of your American Cancer Society. Guard your family and strike back against cancer. Mail a generous contribution to Cancer in care of your local post office. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
That's going to do it for this episode of Case Closed. Hope you enjoyed it. You can find more from Secrets of Scotland Yard, Whitehall 1212, more Case Closed, thousands of other old-time radio shows, and all the other podcasts at relicradio.com. You can donate through the website as well if you'd like to. We've got some downloadable sets for certain donation amounts, though any amount is always helpful. Thanks to those who have helped out, and thanks for joining me today. Be back next Wednesday with another episode of Case Closed.